Hello, everyone. I'm Rania Kalik, and this is Dispatches. As Israel's genocide in Gaza has horrified the world for nearly 7 months, there are growing discussions in the U.S. around the nature of its relationship with Israel. There are several popular mainstream narratives that have sought to explain this relationship with a discourse centered around shared values, democracy, sympathy for European persecution against Jews throughout history, and a clash of civilizations that imagines a Judeo-Christian culture in need of protection from the barbaric authoritarian Arab masses. Others frame Israel as a nuisance to U.S. elites, a state that hurts U.S. interests in a classic case of the tail wagging the dog through an Israel lobby that pressures and intimidates and throws money around to sway U.S. policy in Israel's favor. But these arguments are flawed and distort the true nature of the relationship. Yes, Israel needs the U.S., but the U.S. also needs Israel because Israel is an arm of U.S. imperialism, a Western outpost that protects U.S. empire's will in the Middle East. It always has been. The Israel lobby is just an extension of the U.S. military-industrial complex that keeps elected officials in line. And sure, there are sometimes contradictions between Israeli government officials and ruling U.S. elites, depending on which party's in charge, but this doesn't change the general paradigm of Israel as a strategic U.S. investment and a proxy that sustains U.S. global domination in an important region. Meaning the struggle for justice in Palestine is actually a struggle against U.S. imperialism itself. Joining me to discuss this and more is Richard Becker, author of the book Palestine, Israel and the U.S. Empire. But before we jump into it, this is just part of this episode. The full interview is available to Breakthrough News members only. You can become a member at patreon.com/breakthroughnews. Richard Becker, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's a real pleasure to have you on. I'm so excited to hear your thoughts and analysis based on this wonderful book you wrote, which I've been perusing. It's fantastic. I highly recommend people check it out. Palestine, Israel, and the U.S. Empire. This is the latest edition, so you have some updates post October 7th. But before we get into that, you know, we're recording this on Monday, May 6th. And I say that only because I'm not sure once this comes out, if a Rafah invasion by the Israeli army will have started or not. It seems to be very, very likely that that's going to happen within the coming days, perhaps. And Rafah is, of course, the part of Gaza where over 1 million Palestinians have been sheltering and still getting bombed and dying of starvation and thirst and all of the other things happening in the rest of Gaza, though they were told to evacuate to Rafah, and now this supposed safe zone is, you know, they're once again being told to evacuate. So I'm just curious, before we get into the book, your general thoughts on the current situation, which just seems to get worse and worse as time passes.
Well, it's a looming catastrophe. It already appears to be underway in its first stages, and the concentration of people and the conditions that they're living in are already and have been for several months catastrophic. An Israeli military operation, particularly given the fact that the Israeli military and the political leadership have no interest in the survival of the people. In fact, what they are doing appears to be an attempt to destroy as much of the population of Gaza as possible, either through bombs and mortars or through starvation, disease. But you can see that this is really aimed at eliminating the population or as much of the population as possible.
Yeah, it's really, really horrifying. I mean, it's just like, I think, you know, we're just about the 7 month point of this horrific genocide. And, you know, I think it's really important to have you on to talk about this specific topic now, because obviously this is the biggest story in the world happening, this genocide in Gaza. It's a moment where people are learning, in some cases for the first time, are learning about Palestine, the colonization of Palestine, the Zionist movement. And there's a lot of various ways that the mainstream and then even some on the left are explaining the U.S. relationship with Israel, right? Because people see that the U.S. is willing to do anything for Israel. It's willing to send a limitless amount of weapons with no conditions, even if it's committing a genocide. It's willing to use its UN Security Council vote to constantly veto any attempt at accountability or even just like a basic ceasefire. It's willing to protect Israel from the ICE, from being, you know, Israeli officials from being prosecuted at the International Criminal Court. And I could go on and on and on. You see like every member of Congress, every member, every president of university, you know, is basically like pledging allegiance in many ways to whatever Israel wants to do to Palestinians. And they're willing to deploy police to you know, fire tear gas and rubber bullets at students who are just asking their universities to divest from genocide. All that's to say a lot of the reasons, a lot of the ways this behavior is explained is either that, you know, Israel and the U.S. have shared values, or I think the more popular version of why the U.S. supports Israel without any condition is the idea of the Israel lobby. And so, Richard, that, you know, one thing that comes to mind is the very important book by Stephen Walt and John Mearsheimer, which argues that, you know, the power of the Israel lobby, which makes it very politically risky to threaten, you know, any meaningful reductions in U.S. support to Israel, is the reason Israel or U.S. supports Israel. And in fact, Israel's policies, Israel's behavior, in many ways, Israel's existence in the Middle East is actually, you know, bad for the U.S. In many ways. And that's why there has to be this Israel lobby. So I'm rambling now, but that's all to say we get these different explanations for why the U.S. supports Israel. And I want to ask you to explain from your perspective what it is that actually drives U.S. unconditional support for this settler colony in the Middle East.
Well, first of all, I'd like to say that in one respect, the Mearsheimer-Walt book is quite useful in showing the, you know, just what the real character is of our so-called representatives. And I don't mean they really are representatives, but you know, they spend most of their time raising money. So if you offer them money, they'll follow you anywhere. And they've done this with the pro-Israel lobby, and it's been allowed to develop political power because it's marching in lockstep with U.S. foreign policy. But I think that the real cause of the vast funding of Israel that goes on from the United States, hundreds of billions of dollars now, and adding up all continually, is that from Washington's point of view, Israel is a giant military base, and it's a giant military base that is an extension of U.S. power and U.S. domination. It's an essential element. From the point of view of the Pentagon and the White House, an essential element in the U.S. strategy of global domination. You know, and so what Israel has been able to do for the United States is it's almost impossible to describe how extensive that has been. It's, whether it was, you know, retraining and training and arming the Guatemalan military back in the 1980s when they were committing genocide against the Mayan people, or providing the atomic bomb to South Africa at the time of the apartheid regime there. But most of all, and beyond any doubt, is the distorting effect, the impact on development in the Middle East itself, where Israel is really an implantation. It's an implant, a European implantation in the heart of the Arab world. And it has distorted life and development in that region to the benefit of imperialism, of U.S. imperialism in particular, for many decades now. And I think that's why they get the money that they get. There are differences between the U.S. and Israel over foreign policy, because Israel's priority is land. It's a land-hungry regime, and it has been ever since the time of the U.N. vote. They were not satisfied. The leaders of the early leaders of the state of Israel, they were never satisfied with their borders. From the very beginning, they believed that those borders were only temporary, that they would conquer Gaza, they would conquer the West Bank, maybe they would conquer a large part of Lebanon. They wanted to do all of those things, and at various times did. And so that's their priority. U.S. priority is managing a global empire. And what the friction between the U.S. and Israel, to the extent that it exists, and it's not decisive by any means, has to do with the fact that the U.S. is managing the largest empire that's ever existed, and Israel is making people inside the empire who are oppressed by the empire very angry at Israel, but also very angry at the U.S. for providing the means by which Israel carries out this genocidal war and their oppression of the Palestinian people.
That's so important to break down. And I want to kind of elaborate on some of the points you made. But first, I want to ask you, why does it matter how we frame this relationship? Like, why does it matter that we understand it in the context of Israel as this huge U.S. military base versus the idea that, you know, obviously, yes, there is an Israel lobby in the U.S. and we can get into some of the specifics about why that lobby exists in a bit. But why does it matter, having a specific understanding of Israel as an extension of America rather than, oh, it's actually the Israelis and their lobby running U.S. policy, and that's the reason we support Israel? Like, what does it matter?
Well, I mean, if you accept the argument or the idea that Israel controls the U.S., you would have to be talking about something that is really contrary to a materialist objective understanding. How would a country of, say, Israel's up to 9 million people now, with a large percentage of those not Israeli Jewish population, but Palestinian population, but it's 9 million people compared to the United States, which is 350 million or 340 million people now. The U.S. is an empire that's like never been seen before, 800 military bases around the world and so on and so forth, and vast resources, huge military. And the idea that Israel somehow could control the United States really leads you in a very dangerous direction. And I think that dangerous direction is the long-time conspiracy theories that sometimes were called the Jewish banker, you know, industrialist, and et cetera. All these theories that somehow, in the end, really come down to true anti-Semitism and the idea that somehow there's a worldwide conspiracy and it's controlled by Israel and it's controlled by Jewish people. That's a false idea. And if you believe that, and that becomes your analysis, then you're headed, I think, in a very negative direction.
There's that. And, you know, I think there's also the importance of like recognizing that we can't let imperialism off the hook, right? Like, it's like, and you make this point in your book, it would be like blaming U.S. Cuba policy on the anti-Cuba fascists who lobby for a blockade of Cuba. And to understand it that way would be to misunderstand U.S. imperialism. It's like you're missing the elephant in the room if you're not recognizing that this is a U.S. imperial asset, that the blockade of Cuba serves U.S. imperialism. It also serves Cuban fascists. But first and foremost, it serves Cuban imperialism, and also you know, Cuban fascists also serve U.S. imperialism. But I feel like that, you know, that's like an important element here too. If we don't understand the nature of this relationship, you can't protest it properly.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're really going, as I said, it takes you off in a bad direction. Mm-hmm. And to not understand what the Palestinians are really facing. You know, they, and the Palestinian movement has talked about this from the beginning, that the more radical wing of the movement has always seen that their enemy is a threefold enemy. That is, first, of course, the state of Israel and its military. Secondly, U.S. imperialism, or maybe first, U.S. imperialism and imperialism in general. And thirdly, the reactionary Arab regimes, these family monarchies and dictatorships that exist, supported by the U.S. And increasingly friendly to the state of Israel. The Palestinians really face an incredible array of forces against them. But it's important to understand that really it is U.S. imperialism that makes it possible for the state of Israel. And this has been true since the beginning of the Zionist project. It had to have a sponsor. At the beginning, it had no army and no navy. How could it be a colonizing force? It aspired to be, but it couldn't really be a colonizing force without an army and a navy. And when they didn't have their own, they had to find one. And first it was the British. Then in the 50s and early 60s, it was France. And then today, and since 1968, it's been the United States. But one of those the major imperialist powers' support has been necessary for the state of Israel to exist in the past and to exist in the present.
And that's a really good segue into what I wanted to ask you next. And I want to, you know, before we get into the various ways that Israel has served U.S. interests throughout its history, I want to go back to its founding. And even before its founding, because a lot of the popular narratives, and I'm talking here about mainstream narratives, they'll suggest that Israel was founded out of this, you know, necessity because Jews weren't safe in Europe. And they weren't safe in Europe. That's true. That Herzl, you know, Theodor Herzl, had to, you know, go around and beg for support. He got British support for this Jewish colony. And then, of course, the Holocaust made it happen. But this also, you know, this ignores the strategic nature of it as an outpost for the West. But also it ignores the chopping up of the Middle East. Because, you know, the idea of a Jewish state happened in conjunction, or the actual implementation, I should say, when the West got behind it, was happening in conjunction with the chopping up of the Middle East, the Sykes-Picot Agreement. And I'm just curious if you could put the Zionist project into that broader imperialist context that led up to the founding of Israel, which, you know, I'm not denying that the Holocaust or the persecution of European Jews certainly helped reinforce the ideas of Zionist leaders, you know, to go around and ask for help with a Jewish state. But it was kind of in the works before all that happened.
Well, yes. And as you say, there was a search for a sponsoring empire on the part of the early founders of Zionism. Theodor Herzl succeeded by Chaim Weizmann. And between the first meeting, First World Zionist Congress in 1897, it was about 20 years until they found their sponsor. And that was the British government. In the midst of World War I, they issued the Balfour Declaration. And that came from Arthur Balfour, who was the foreign minister, foreign secretary of the British Empire. 2 years earlier, the British had sent, and I think this very much pertains to the point about the modern Middle East. 2 years earlier, they had sent an envoy to the Middle East to talk to leaders of the emerging Arab National Movement and the Hashemite Kingdom in the south of what is today now south of Saudi Arabia. And they promised the Arab people who were then within the Ottoman Empire. They were, and the Ottoman Empire was an enemy of the British Empire in the war, in World War I, that if the Arab people fought on the side of the British, the British would support them having an independent state at the end. The next year, in 1916, was the Sykes-Picot secret treaty that was negotiated between the British, French, and Russian empires. Others were included in it. And it was a plan for how, once they had conquered the Ottoman Empire, they would divide it up among themselves. And so you have that. And the Balfour Declaration came on November 2nd, 1917, saying that the British government supported a quote-unquote national home for the Jewish people in Palestine. 5 days later was the Russian Revolution. And the relevance of that is that the new revolutionary government of Russia published the Sykes-Picot Treaty a few weeks after it took power. And so the people in the Middle East, in the Arab world, find out in late 1917 that not only was that a big lie about the support for an independent Arab state, but that, in fact, the bigger colonizers were taking over, and Lebanon and Syria became French colonies, Iraq, Jordan, Palestine became British colonies. The British stranglehold on Egypt was tightened even more. And so then in the midst of that, in the middle of the Arab world, which is being cut up by the imperialists, they expressed support for a European colony in the very heart of the Arab world. And that's how the modern Middle East really came into being. And it's virtually unknown here. In the Middle East, it's very well known. Mm-hmm. Sykes-Picot, people know what Sykes-Picot means. They know what Balfour means. But part of the purpose of our book is, you know, to people who are interested in this subject, to know where the modern Middle East came from and what was the part played by the Zionist colonial movement in that.
Yeah, Europeans love to chop up the global South, don't they? I mean, they get together, yeah, have these conferences, and they decide this goes to Europe, or this goes to France, this goes to Britain, this goes to Germany. I mean, even today in Lebanon, you know, one of the languages is French. Like much of Africa, you know, there's a huge part of Africa where everyone speaks French. It's because, yeah, of this, and people in the U.S. just don't know that. But, you know, to go on from that, there's another common narrative that I would like you to debunk, and that is the idea, you know, you'll often hear in the mainstream that, you know, Israel and the U.S., they have these shared Judeo-Christian values, right? They're both like democracies. Poor Israel surrounded by just like hordes of barbaric Arabs, and it's sad for them, and we have to help them. But also it's put into the context of this sympathy for Jewish people, that like we have to support Israel because Jews have been so persecuted. We had to support the founding of Israel because Jews have been so persecuted. And this is such a pretense, obviously, because like you're basically using these people as human shields for imperialism. But even when it comes to the founding of Israel, I actually wanted to ask you this question. There's this common belief that nobody really knew about the Holocaust until after it happened. Mm-hmm. Did we know that? Did the Europeans know what the Nazis were? Did America know what the Nazis were doing? I should ask. Did they know what was happening? Maybe not the extent of it, but did they know what was happening and just not intervene? Or what was the case there? And is this really about protecting the Jewish people when they're supporting the creation of Israel?
Well, you know, just before around the time that the war started, I believe it was in 1940 in Europe, there was a bill, a proposition that came before the U.S. Congress to allow 20,000 German Jewish children to be allowed in above the quota. There was a very racist quota system, very discriminatory, but it failed. And Franklin Roosevelt, who was then president, refused to get behind it. We quote in the book his cousin, who was married to the U.S. Commissioner of Immigration at the time, saying, "And 20,000 beautiful children will all too soon turn into 20,000 ugly adults." This is in the ruling class of the United States. I mean, the level of anti-Semitism within the ruling class was so great that Roosevelt, who was a liberal, didn't want to go up against it, But so the idea that nobody knew what was happening, no, I mean, this was in 1939 or 1940. So, but later on, there was an appeal made. You know, the killing in the concentration camps was murder on an industrial scale. You can't, without an industrial scale, you know, they couldn't have killed that many people. And there was an appeal made to deter or destroy some of the industrial apparatus, particularly railroads. Mm-hmm. The railroads were coming into the camps, and sometimes people were going right out of boxcars where they had been confined into gas chambers. So there was an appeal made repeatedly, bomb the rail lines. The British and the U.S. pilots, bombers were flying hundreds or thousands of missions a day over Germany and Poland, German-held Europe. And the commanders refused to do it and said it wasn't strategic to do so. You know, before the war, some of the leading families, and this is very important to all of this, the Kennedys, the Fords, the Bushes, they were all very pro-Nazi, pro-German, mm-hmm, pro-Nazi. And it was them, along with them, the America First movement, headed by Charles Lindbergh, which they were very anti-Semitic. They were profoundly anti-Semitic. In 1943, the only Jewish member of the U.S. cabinet, Henry Morgenthau, the Secretary of the Treasury, went so far as to have his department write a report attacking the State Department. I've never heard of this happening at any other time in U.S. history. Maybe it has, but and saying that the State Department not only was not helping to relieve the mass slaughter, the genocide that was going on against Jewish people and also against other people, Slavic people, you know, 2/3 of the Roma people were destroyed by the Nazis. But he said, not only is our the government, the State Department and the government not helping, it's making matters worse. After the war, then they all pretend, once the decision was made and it was a big fight over it, to support the creation of the State of Israel, then they would try to, the leaders in Washington would invoke the great sympathy for what had happened to Jewish people in order to, for another purpose, the creation of the Zionist state.
Yeah, it's so twisted, using one genocide to essentially justify another. But I want to talk to you about Israel's role historically to today in serving U.S. imperial interests. So let's give some concrete examples here. I think there's a few times worth highlighting when Israel served imperial interests. I mean, the Cold War, you know, comes to mind. There's Israel's role when it comes to Egypt, when it comes to Iraq, when it comes to Syria, Lebanon, and even beyond the Middle East. So, I mean, let's start with the Middle East during the Cold War, because Israel did play a role, a significant role then. So can you talk about, you know, in Israel's younger days, what was Israel's role in serving imperial interests, particularly when it came to the Cold War in the region?
Well, you know, I think that another forgotten chapter, and there are many forgotten chapters in this story in the U.S., but one is that in 1956, the Israeli government, headed by David Ben-Gurion at the time, colluded first with France, and then they brought the British in on it too, to overthrow the government in Egypt. And the idea here was that what had happened was Nasser, Gamal Abdel Nasser, who was the president of Egypt and the most prominent Arab leader of the time of the Arab National Movement, had nationalized the Suez Canal in 1956. The Suez Canal was a waterway entirely within Egypt, but this was treated as a great insult. And the New York Daily News had a full-page headline that said, "The Hitler of the Nile." About Nasser for having dared to nationalize the canal. The British and the French had owned the canal. The British were the primary holders. They wanted the canal back. France was fighting the Algerian Revolution and believed that if they could shut down, they could overthrow the Nasser government and shut down Free Radio Algeria, that they would be able to defeat the Algerian Revolution. And the Israelis wanted land. And their idea, and they presented it to the other people just before the war started, was that Jordan should be done away with as a country. Iraq should absorb Jordan on the condition that they would accept, they would take in all the Palestinian refugees. Israel would get the Litani River, Lebanon up to the Litani River. They would get Gaza. They would get the West Bank. They would get the whole Sinai Peninsula. That was a little too much for their partners. They started the war. It was a provocation. It crashed and burned as an idea. But the idea was based on land hunger. They were willing to do this, and they were willing to assist. And the U.S. stopped it. They intervened in this, Eisenhower, because the British and French hadn't told the U.S. that they were going to do this. And he also threatened Israel to be thrown out of the United Nations and finished as a country. So they had to back away, but it showed what the idea was. 11 years later, in 1967, was the Six-Day War, which was presented in the U.S. as a defensive war by Israel against looming catastrophe. 20 years later, the leaders, Moshe Dayan, Menachem Begin, would report, well, that's not really what happened. We were not really facing a dire threat. But that, of course, is when Golan Heights, West Bank, Gaza, East Jerusalem, and for a time, the whole Sinai Peninsula were conquered by Israel. And this was viewed very favorably in Washington. Gerald Ford, who was the House Minority Leader, later he would be president, he said to the effect, Israel has really done the job we needed done, something like that. That was a time when Syria was being called the Cuba of the Middle East. And there was a high point of radicalism where this smashing of the Syrian and Egyptian militaries and the Jordanian Air Force as well was a big setback. It was a huge setback to the Arab National Movement and particularly its more revolutionary forces. Later, there would be an end to Israel's control of Sinai, but the rest of those territories that I mentioned remain under Israeli control, but in a war that really was to the advantage of Washington and U.S. imperialism, as well as to the Israeli government, and was viewed as the signal that the U.S. should begin pouring billions of dollars under Nixon, who was elected in 1968, to Israel to really build it up and make it the kind of the Western pole, with Iran as the Eastern pole when the Shah was still there, of control over the Middle East.
Yeah, and not to mention, I mean, then you get to the Lebanese Civil War, and you had the U.S. and Israel basically like supporting fascists against leftists and all the pro-Palestine movements and armed groups and the Palestinian resistance themselves that was based in Lebanon. And on and on. I mean, it's one country after another after another. And that's throughout the Cold War era. I wanted to ask about if we could zoom out a little bit, because Israel's usefulness wasn't limited just to the Middle East. You had also Latin America. I mean, Israel's played quite the role across Latin America, for example. So I'm curious if you could just give some examples where Israel comes into play as being, you know, doing, I guess, I don't know what you would call it, like a reinforcement for the U.S. maybe?
Yeah, I think that one of the things that Israel has done is things that the U.S. wanted done but didn't want to be seen responsible for. And that's important. So 1982, 83, there was a big debate in the United States in the Congress about funding for the Guatemalan military. And U.S. funding was cut off in 83, or at least officially cut off. and the Guatemalan army was carrying out genocide. Even people, you know, like top leaders of the U.S. would later say, yeah, it was genocide when it was done. But genocide against the Mayan population, which is a rebellion against, you know, who are the vast majority of the people in Guatemala, but ruled by a European descended elite. And so Israel stepped in, became the trainers of the military, armed them. The Galil rifle produced in Israel became the standard field weapon for the Guatemalan military. And the genocide went on. But now it could appear that it wasn't the U.S. that was responsible. It was someone else. Israel supported the fascist military junta in Chile. And then beyond Latin America, as I mentioned, in 1979, Israel, working with the apartheid regime in South Africa, with which it had excellent relations, and with the other racist regimes, like in Rhodesia, as Zimbabwe was still called, they detonated an atomic bomb in the South Atlantic. And that's how South Africa got the atomic bomb. And why did the U.S. want that? Because at that time, South Africa was not only an apartheid state exploiting the black population internally, it also was assigned the role of protecting U.S. imperialist and other imperialist interests in all of sub-Saharan Africa. So it would go to war after Angolan independence in late 1975. It would go to war against the government. It was only really the intervention of Cuban troops armed by the Soviet Union together with the Angolan military that prevented Angola in 1976 from becoming a South African colony. And this was all considered, this was all supported by the U.S., but the U.S. at the time didn't want to be seen publicly as supporting the apartheid regime.
You know, some people, there's been this argument too that, and this is also kind of a more mainstream argument among some of the more liberal types. One person that comes to mind is Stephen Simon. He's the former U.S. National Security Council Senior Director for the Middle East and North Africa. That's a mouthful, under Obama. So he played a role during the Obama years, and obviously Obama, you know, his team helped negotiate the Iran nuclear deal, something that the Israelis were actively lobbying against. I mean, you remember Netanyahu came to Congress and gave a speech where he advocated against the policy of a sitting U.S. president, which was kind of insane. But Stephen Simon wrote this book. It's called Our Separate Ways, The Struggle for the Future of the U.S.-Israel Alliance. And in it, he makes this argument that, you know, is kind of about how Israel's no longer needed like it once was. Not that the U.S. should like cut off ties with Israel or anything like that, but that there's obviously this like fracture and Israel's not as useful as it once was. And he kind of portrays it in this really like, you know, paternalistic way where it's like Israel's our child and it needs to just like grow up. But the reason I bring that up is because, you know, we talked about a lot of the things that Israel did in the past, but now there's this idea that, oh, it doesn't really do so much anymore. Like, now it's just this, you know, country that doesn't listen to us. It goes rogue all the time. It's like a, you know, child throwing a temper tantrum. And we don't, like, it's actually like, it makes us less safe as a country. This is kind of the liberal capitalist argument from certain segments of liberal America that you'll hear. So I'm curious, when we talk about more modern times, like let's say the last 30 years, how has Israel in the last 30 years, you know, served U.S. imperialist interests?
Well, I think if you look at just in kind of an overall, if you look at what the direction of U.S. foreign policy is today, it's shifting its main priority from West Asia to East Asia with the pivot to Asia, so-called. And but the Middle East and North Africa remains very important, very strategic. Palestine, you know, is at a crossroads of three continents, Asia, Africa, and Europe. And you could argue that the fact that the U.S. is shifting so much of its force to preparation for war with China, which would be, you know, unbelievably catastrophic, or have unbelievably catastrophic consequences, but they're doing it, that could make Israel more important, not less important to the U.S., because the relationship, I mean, Israel, as I said many times before, Israel is a small country, but a large military base, a very large. And one of the things that we've seen revealed in the course of what's happened since October 7th is that the U.S. has a lot of supplies in a lot of the prepositioning of vast quantities of material there. So the idea, as you said earlier, of the, you know, the Judea, shared Judeo-Christian, blah, 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 you know, that's what it is. It's just blah, blah, blah. The reality is that Israel is really, it really serves the interests of U.S. imperialism in that part of the world above all. And that's how they see it. And that's not, by the way, that's not really a relationship of friendship.
No.
You know, it's like a high paid security guard for U.S. interests in the Middle East.
And also, I mean, you mentioned something earlier that kind of just made my mind go to what Israel does in Iran, right? When the U.S. like wants, when Israel does America's dirty work, like things the U.S. isn't quite comfortable doing on paper. And it makes me think of Israel killing Iranian scientists, for example.
Yeah.
That's not something that happens outside of some sort of coordination with the U.S. Military security, whatever you want to call it, intelligence apparatus, in the sense that the U.S. is all good with that. Israel is very much needed to counter Iran, which, you know, when it comes to the Middle East, America sees Iran, or West Asia, America sees Iran as like the big enemy. If it were to like pull out its support for Israel, it would just, the U.S. would say, this will just hand it right over to Iran. And we can't possibly risk that. But I want to ask you about October 7th now and the genocide in Gaza, because now I'm of a couple opinions here. I think that October 7th and Israel is really an actual failure in a security sense to be able to deal with an attack from Palestinian resistance groups acting out of a death camp, well, what's now turned into a death camp, acting out of a concentration camp in Gaza, shows that it's not actually as strong as it tries to portray itself as being. So if I was the U.S., I'd be slightly concerned that my military base is not, you know, in tip-top shape. But more importantly, I guess, you know, I have thoughts on why the U.S. is supporting the genocide in Gaza, but I'm curious your take on that. Why? You know, why support this gruesome eradication of Palestinians in Gaza that Israel's carrying out right now? I mean, obviously, there's some differences in how the U.S. would prefer to see this genocide, this war waged, as they've said publicly, but otherwise, they're supporting it, like, no question. So what does the U.S. get out of it?
Well, I think that what, I mean, it's terrible that the U.S. is doing what it's doing. And those bombs, the planes that drop the bombs, that's all coming from the U.S. And mm-hmm. it continues to. There's been, we don't really know how many emergency resupplies of bombs there have been, but there have been many. The last time I saw it was 28. So the U.S. government is more than going along with Israel. It's really a partner in the war against the people of Gaza. They, of course, want to crush all resistance movements to imperialism, regardless if they're led by communists or Islamists, whoever it is who's resisting the U.S. The U.S. wants to crush them there. And all over the region and all over the world. I mean, that's their, you know, the kind of it's a lodestar of their foreign policy is to defeat revolutionary and progressive and resistance movements that stand in the way of empire. So at the same time,
if you enjoyed this episode and want to hear the rest, you can access it by becoming a Breakthrough News member at patreon.com/breakthroughnews.